Yeah, so we'll stay in the world of cold atoms for this talk, and what I'll tell you about is ensembles of atoms which are magnetically trapped with the help of little, very simple micro circuits. And this is work done in a small subgroup within the group of Ted Hensch at the Max Planck Institute for Quantum Optics and the University of Munich. And I'll first try to motivate why at all this could be interesting for quantum information processing, and then I'll go on telling you a bit about how this kind of trapping and manipulation works. And in particular, I'll show an experiment about Bose-Einstein condensation in such a microtrap, and then I'll go on to present some ongoing projects in this domain. So Philippe already pointed out why or how neutral atoms could be used for as qubits and for the processing. First of all, I mean, an atom has is interesting because there are these very well developed techniques for manipulating their internal as well as external states, and in particular, there are atoms which have a split ground state, so that you could use these ground substates as qubit states, and these are very long-lived and also have long-living coherences. So this might be interesting to look at. And then, of course, you have to do something to your atoms. You don't want them to run around like mad in a gas cell. So that's what the trapping part is about. And later on, of course, I will also have to say what we think we could use to couple them. But first, as I said, you want to stop these atoms and get a grip on them. And the key technique for this is laser cooling. And the idea itself dates back to the 1970s, and the key techniques were developed in the 1980s. And nowadays, the workhorse for slowing down atoms is the so-called magneto-optical trap, which works with a combination of six laser beams from all the along all the spatial axes, combined with a small magnetic field, which defines a trapping center. And with these techniques, you can slow the atoms to an equivalent temperature on the order of 10 microkelvins, which means that they move at a speed of just a few centimeters per second, which must be compared to the thermal velocities of 1 kilometer per second. And in such a magneto-optical trap, you get densities around 10 to the 10 per cubic centimeter. So this is very dilute compared to the solid state. And the number of atoms that you can trap in such a thing varies between a million and 10 to the 10, roughly. The history of this laser cooling is very interesting in itself, and was rewarded by the 1997 Nobel Prize. Unfortunately, there's no time to go into that now, but I mean, for example, there was in the early theory, it was thought that the limiting temperature would be given by the line width of the atom, which does the velocity selection, and would lead to temperatures in the millikelvin regime. But then when the experiments were done, it turned out that you could get orders of magnitude lower. And so so this is something that rarely happens, right? That it works better than you thought. And so theories were made, and very subtle effects were found. But anyway, we just have to skip this to go on to the next point, which is you don't just want to cool the atoms, you want to trap them so that you can work with the same atom for a long time. And one option for this is magnetic trap, which works like this. Well, you have the magnetic sublevels within the ground state of your atom, and of course, well, they tune with different signs with respect to the magnetic field. So if you take this upper state, this is a so-called weak field seeking state. This can be trapped in the minimum of magnetic field, and such a minimum is conveniently produced by a pair of coils with antisymmetric currents in them. So this gives a quadrupole trap in which you can trap atoms. And very similar ideas were used as early as the 1950s to trap neutrons by Wolfgang Pauli and co-workers. And it took a long time until they were actually applied to neutral atoms. And this is easy to see why this is the case. When you look at the orders of magnitude, the magnetic energy or the magnetic field that you need to confine an atom which has an equivalent temperature of just 1 Kelvin is about 1.5 Tesla. So a magnetic field that you can do in the lab as seen by a thermal atom, it just looks like a little bump in the road. It just goes over it. So in order to use it for trapping, you first need laser cooling to work. Now, when you compare these magnetic traps to the optical traps that Philippe has presented in the last talk, then it may look like a foolish thing to do to use these magnetic traps when you can also use dipole beams to do the trapping. Because a dipole trap traps all ground state sublevels, whereas in a magnetic trap, only certain levels are trapped while the others are exposed. And the confinement that you typically get if you don't want to work too hard is much stronger in the case of a dipole trap than it is in the case of a magnetic trap. And furthermore, of course, when you think of qubits, then you want multiple traps, and you get them for free if you use several optical beams which intersect, because then they you get an interference pattern which gives a regular structure where you can trap a lot of atoms. Although it must be said that the spacing here is just lambda over 2, so it's not straightforward to address individual atoms in such an optical lattice. But with magnetic coils, there seems to be no easy way to even get just 2 or 3 lattice sites, 2 or 3 individual trapping sites that you could work with. And what ideally you would like to have is not just a periodic structure, but designer potentials. I mean, arrays of potentials that you can move around so that you can couple the qubits that you want to couple, or a conveyor belt to move in fresh qubits for error corrections and so on. And now what I'm going to tell you is that magnetic traps can be used to do just that, if you don't do them using coils, but instead using current-carrying microstructures on a substrate. So you replace your coils, which are far away from the atoms, by these lithographically produced wires, which you customarily find on microcircuits, just you know, as the wires and conductors that are on every microchip. And what you do then is you send a relatively small current through such a wire, and this generates a magnetic field. And by cleverly arranging the wires, you can get a magnetic trapping structure again, as in the case of the coils. But in this case, you can get all the potentials that you want, because you can very easily make quite complicated structures, like this, for example. You're not restricted to just 1 or 2 trapping sites anymore, and you can choose the kinds of potentials that you want. Here, for example, you see a number of trapped clouds in with the spacing which is given by the lithography that was done on that chip up there. And so, furthermore, the fields that you get, so the confinement you get, is much stronger than in the case of coils, because you're so much closer to the current carrying structure. So there are several ways in which you could implement this general idea. The way we do it is, starting from a current-carrying wire, which has this 1 over r magnetic potential to it. This alone is not a trap yet, because you want a minimum, and you don't have a minimum here except at infinity. So you superpose an external homogeneous field And the superposition of the two looks like this. And it has a minimum parallel to the wire at some distance from the wire, which can be adjusted by the relative strength of the two fields. Another way of looking at it is you take this field, you add this homogeneous field to it. So you shift down this line. And because it's the modulus of the field which you're interested in, you have to flip it around. And then you get this trapping structure. And with only a current of 1 amp, you get a trap which is much steeper than anything you can do with simple coil structures. And to get a closed trap, what you do is you bend the wire at the end. So in these regions here, the field from the wire and the external field no longer cancel. And this is what closes the trap. And here you see a potential plot of a typical structure. This is what we actually use in the experiment, 50 micron wide wires. So you see they are not really nanoscopic. There's a lot of headroom here for miniaturization. And 2 millimeter long. And this is the potential that you get for an external field of 80 gauss, which is quite manageable. And you see that you get a field gradient on the order of Tesla per centimeter. And how do we do this in practice? Well, again, there are several methods, but what we just need for now is these lithographic wires on the substrate. So we take ceramic substrates, and we looked for a commercial process to have the lithography done on top of it. So actually, it's not what's used for producing pentiums, but it's used for packaging them. Right, it's like a miniature circuit board with these gold wires on it, and then we glue it onto a copper block for removing the heat. And here you see the thing mounted in a small glass cell in which there's a reasonably good but not extremely good vacuum. And what you also see here is that we have a mirror layer. Well, it's not a perfect mirror, but it's I tell you, it's supposed to be a mirror on top of the substrate there. And the reason we applied this mirror is that we want the magneto-optical trap to work. And the normal magneto-optical trap has these 6 beams which cross in one point. So if you want to combine this with a substrate, you're stuck because it drops a shadow. So what we do is we reflect 2 of the mod beams off this mirror on the substrate. And the first good surprise was that this modified mod actually works just as good as a normal optical trap. And starting from there, we managed to, in a sequence of steps, involving a mod and then moving it closer to the surface, we actually got the first microscopic chip magnetic trap to work. And by the way we take these images is we have the substrate mounted upside down so that the atoms are hanging below it, and then we have a probe beam which goes parallel to the substrate, and we look with the camera. So you see the substrate is up here and the atoms hanging below, and what you may be able to see here, these shadows, these are the soldering contacts where in the first version of the chip we just soldered contacts, and this is the solder bumps which you see. So this gives you an idea of the scale. Well, as it worked so nicely, we proceeded to more complicated structures. And one thing we did was an atomic conveyor belt, which works like this. You have, again, a long wire bent at the end, as before. So this gives an elongated trap. But now we additionally have these wiggly wires there, which modulate the elongated potential to give you such a structure here. And now the nice thing is, when you apply sinusoidally modulated currents to these two wires with a phase shift between them, then these potentials start moving, and you can and this is a continuous process. You can go as slowly or as fast as you want by choosing this this phase speed of the modulated currents. And indeed, when we load our atom clouds here into the first two potentials, you can see that by by applying this modulation, we can move them. And by the way, each of these clouds contains about 10 to the 5 atoms at a temperature of about 30 or 40 microkelvin. So this is these ensembles still occupy a lot of vibrational levels in the magnetic trap. And now by applying more currents to the additional wires here and there, I'll show you some of the things you can do. Up here you see what you saw on the previous slide. So the atoms being moved by applying sinusoidal currents. And then we thought, well, they move up and down a bit, which is not what you want. You just want them to transport them on a straight line, because otherwise this might heat up the sample. And so we applied a more complicated current modulation, which is no longer sinusoidal. And indeed, as you see down here, you can get a much smoother movement by just using a more complicated current modulation. All this is controlled by computer, of course. And another thing you can do is you can start with two ensembles, one here and one there, and then just switch off everything except the very elongated potential so that the two clouds collide. And once you are able to populate just one vibrational level, then this may be interesting for studying the collisions between the clouds. And what you see here is that there are just no collisions. Another thing is that you can start from an initial reservoir and split up parts, little partial clouds, to transport the atoms to somewhere else. And again, with a thermal cloud, it may not be immediately applicable to quantum computing, but maybe you get already an idea that this is something that is worthwhile considering. You can also, by switching on or off the wire which is here, you can either split off a cloud or not. So you can use that to as an atom source. And here's the one I like best. Here you split the initial ensemble into subclouds, and then you bring them together to overlap. Now, if you think about what this would give if you had a coherent atomic ensemble, this can make you dream. I mean, you could coherently split up the cloud in several parts. So can we use this, for example, for interferometry? Well, I'll talk about this later on in the talk. No, it's actually time goes on linearly. But what I have to say is it's destructive imaging. So for each image, we have to start with a new ensemble of atoms. And then every time we run the process for a bit longer and then take another image. Okay, so but this was all on clouds of atoms, so back to the hard part of it. What do we do to entangle these atoms? And well, there's a number of ideas, most of them from this well-known factory in Innsbruck. And Philippe already told you about this Rydberg atom idea. Well, this is new and fancy, but probably it's not the thing to do if you're very close to a material surface, because Rydberg atoms are very sensitive to surface field. So what we think of first of all is the idea of having two atoms collide and having a collisional phase shift, which depends on the internal states of the atom. So how is this done? Of course, Hans Priegel, who is here, can tell you more about this than I can. But briefly, the idea is the following. By combining electrical and magnetical fields, you can you can make trapping potentials which look different depending on the internal state of the atom. So you can make a trap which looks like a single trapping potential for one internal state, but looks like a double well for another internal state. Okay? And so what you do now is you would switch between this separated thing to this conditional trap. Now, depending on the state of the two atoms in these two wells, they either nothing happens, or just one atom starts to oscillate a bit, but not so far as to see the other atom, so nothing happens again. And only if both atoms are in the one state, then they both see the single well potential, and they'll encounter in the middle. And this is what will give the phase shift, which is then used to implement a phase gate. So this is all very nice, but we need more than we actually have to make it work. Because now we have thermal clouds of atoms. So even if it was an individual atom, but at some thermal velocity, then these two atoms in the two wells would just encounter with a not well-defined impact parameter. So the phase shift would be different every time. So clearly what we need to get this phase gate is atoms in or very close to the motional ground state, vibrational ground state of the potential. And well, there is a way of doing just that. That was first done in 1995 with standard magnetic traps, which is Bose-Einstein condensation. This is just that. You have an ensemble of atoms thermally distributed among the vibrational states of the potential. And by this phenomenon known as Bose-Einstein condensation, you put them all in the vibrational ground state. So what you need to get that is on top of the laser cooling, you need another cooling mechanism, which is called evaporative cooling, which bridges the remaining orders of magnitude in phase space density, which you need for this Bose-Einstein condensation to occur. And why is phase space density important for this Bose-Einstein condensation? Well, this is because it's a quantum statistical phenomenon. The basic reason for it is it's just in the different counting statistics for Boltzmannians and bosons. And what happens is that when you cool down the ensemble, there's a certain transition temperature, and when you reach it, then you start to populate the ground state. And once you have some atoms in the ground state due to Bose statistics, the others want to go there as well. And another way of looking at that is thinking of the extension of the de Broglie wave packet of the atom. At the phase space density which you get from laser cooling, the distance, mean distance between atoms, is much larger than the extension of the wave packets. Whereas if you increase the phase space density to about 1, then these wave packets start to overlap, and this is what's needed to get this Bose-Einstein condensation. The problem is, this used to be really hard work. You can see it, for example, from looking at this timeline here. In 1995, the first two experiments on Bose-Einstein condensations started working, and everybody thought, yeah, well, this is it. Let's do it. And so we all went to our labs and started building magnetic traps, etc. But it took more than 2 years until the first follow-up experiments actually started working as well. And well, you can see the apparatus there. It looks much more complicated than what I showed you in the beginning. So Bose-Einstein condensation is not such an easy thing. And why is that? Well, to understand that, we have to look a bit at this process of evaporative cooling. In itself, it's very simple. You just remove the hottest atom from the trap, and then the remaining atoms will thermalize at a lower temperature due to the collisions between the atoms. By slowly always removing the hottest tail of the distribution and then waiting for them to thermalize due to collisions, you get to colder and colder temperatures, and this can go on until this transition. The problem with it is that you need these collisions between the atoms in order for the thing to work. Because when you take an ensemble from a magneto optical trap, which is the starting point, then you have a collision rate of just one collision per second. So it's very slow. And if it's slow, then there's another thing which disturbs you, which is your vacuum is not perfect. So you get collisions with thermal atoms, and they kick out atoms from the trap. So what you want is that these thermalizing collisions occur much faster than the collisions with the background gas, and so you need a very good vacuum, and you need a very tightly confining trap in order to compress your cloud so that you get a high collision rate. And usually, this is why these magnetic traps become very involved and consume several kilowatts of electrical power and have water-cooled coils, etc. Now, one thing that is nice about our microtraps is that you get very strong confinement almost for free. Because you're so much closer to the field-generating structure than you are in a normal trap, that with just one or two amps, you can make very steep potentials like this. And this allowed us to do BEC with just the same very simple apparatus that I've showed you before. And just by ramping up the external field, we could compress the cloud so much that we got an enormous collision rate, and in fact got to Bose-Einstein condensation within a very short time and in this very simple apparatus. And before I show you the result, I have to tell you how these kinds of temperatures are actually measured. Well, what you do is you release the atoms from the trap, so they fall down and they expand according to their temperature distribution. Okay. And so here are images of such an expanding cloud. So you see how it expands here, almost nothing is left, but you can then take a section here and fit a distribution to it. And in that way, you get the temperature distribution of the cloud. And here is what you see when you have Bose condensation. This is such a time of flight image as in last view graph, taken for a constant time, and what you vary is the end point of the evaporative cooling. So as the cloud gets colder, you see that all of a sudden, whoop, there appears a peak in this distribution. If you take a cut, then you see it here. This is the thermal distribution, and here in the middle, you have a sharp peak corresponding to the Bose condensate. So this peak comes from the atoms which are all in the ground state of the potential. And this is what we want. And so in our experiment here is some data, we have about a few thousand atoms in this ground state of the potential. Here's another view of this. This is the classical view used to show Bose condensates. And as we got that, we thought, well, of course, now let's try to transport it on our conveyor belt. And this is what you see here. So this is a Bose condensate transported in the structure, and here we let it fall to reveal the velocity distribution, and you can see that it actually still contains this sharp peak due to the condensed atoms. So this is where we are now. We have an ensemble of a few thousand atoms in the ground state of such a microtrap, and now we can start playing. So number one on our playing list is a trapped atom interferometer. So this is a project that we are working on right now. And the basic idea is this. If you start with, let's say, just one atom in the ground state of a potential, and then you adiabatically split this potential in two, which is something that we can do, then you have these two lobes of the wave function that you can work on individually. For example, you could now have a second atom come from the side and collide with just this half of the wave function of atom one. And then when we do that, we get a phase shift on a local phase shift on one half of the wave function. And now, depending on this phase shift, when we run the process backwards, we either end up in the ground state we came from if this wave function is still symmetric, so if we didn't induce any local phase shift, or if we did induce a phase shift, then we have a probability of ending up in the first excited state. which you can see just from symmetry. So this is an interferometer, an atom interferometer, which works between vibrational states and a potential. Right? This is different from atom interferometers which work, for example, with internal states of the atoms. Here, the internal state doesn't change. The potential for doing it is already there on the chip that we have. So we had already done this a year ago with a thermal cloud. So the splitting and reunification, this works. But now we want to do it with Bose condensates or with individual atoms. And for that, now we have technical problems. We need to improve the stability of our current sources because they induce noise, and this noise heats up the cloud again, and et cetera. So we have technical things to improve, but we know we can do it. And what we have already done, or what Wolfgang Hensel has done, is to do extensive calculation of the wave functions in such a potential and the transition probabilities between them in order to make sure that when we run this process, we are actually in a regime where we can observe interference fringes without spoiling them by all kinds of spurious effects like magnetic field gradients, which are always present, or current noise and things like that. And so these calculations were rather encouraging. So we hope that before too long we can make this interferometer work. And the last thing I want to tell you about is another project that we have, which is to do single atom detection in a way that is compatible with our micro traps. Our dream detector would be a detector which not only detects individual atoms in the trap, but also detects them without kicking them out of the trap, or ideally even without changing the vibrational state. So this is a maximum which is allowed by quantum mechanics, right? You just disturb the phase of the wave function. So in order to do that, you're not allowed to detect spontaneous photons, because clearly spontaneous photons destroy the coherence, or they give a kick to the atoms. So what we want is a dispersive detector. We want to detect the phase shift of light which passes by the atom. And it turns out that the phase shift of a wave which just passes by the atom once is not enough. If you want to make it large enough so that you can detect it, then you automatically also get spontaneous emission. So what you need is a resonator. So we thought about ways of combining a resonator with such a chip. And the first thing we thought of was just a variation of what Jeff Kimball or Gerd Trempel are using. So instead of a concave-concave resonator, in this case you would use a plano-concave resonator, where you have one of these super-duper mirrors here above the substrate, and then you have a very good mirror layer on the substrate itself. But then we saw that maybe, well, this is not a good idea, because then you have the currents below the substrate surface and they will deform the surface and you run into problems. So we thought of alternatives. And right now we're working on two approaches. One is in collaboration with Serge Haroche's group in Paris, where the idea is to use a silica microsphere. These are the best resonators you can get in the world. They have just one problem. The field is confined inside this inside this microsphere, so the only way to access to it is via the evanescent wave. So what you would have to do is to bring the atom so close to the surface of the sphere that it sees the evanescent field. And calculations seem to indicate that it's very hard, but maybe not impossible. And as there was a student in Paris already working on the system, we thought it was worth trying. And he now got his coupler ready, and we're now working on the substrate to try this out. And an alternative approach that we have is to use a fiber resonator, where you have mirror surfaces on the end faces of an optical fiber, and you glue this fiber onto the substrate and form a resonator between these end faces. And in our first tests, we already got a finesse of about 1,000 between the planar surfaces of such a fiber, which is quite surprising when you think that it's not a stable resonator, but it's because the faces are very closely spaced. So then we are working on a more macroscopic conveyor belt so that we can shift the atoms into these resonators. And of course, there are other ideas. We have substrates made for a number of things. This is about what I wanted to tell you. It looks like a coherent interaction might be possible, and this is about all that can be said for now. But if this works out as we hope it does, then this might be a system to do, you know, intermediate scale coherent interactions, and this is certainly something worth my trying. So thank you very much. Yes.
You then said you wrote a phase difference only one component. Was that done optically?
Well, the idea is that you can. To go back a bit. If you just do the potential transformation, then you get back to the state that you came from, namely the ground state. Now. If you do anything that acts locally on one part of the wave function, then the wave function is no longer symmetric, and this is what makes it go to the first excited state when you merge the potential again. This is the idea. So there can be several things which dephase these parts of the wave function. For example, if you instead of doing this horizontally, you would do it vertically, then you would measure gravitational effects. What we want to do with it is have a collision with another atom, okay, on one half of the potential.
In the idea for this collisional control phase gate, the way I understand it is that the atoms are released suddenly from the double well if they're both in the but one, they will collide, and then you have to recapture them.
Yes.
After the collision. Do you have any sense of expectation of how well that recapture can be done? It seems to me to be a fairly complicated coherent control. If they're all harmonic oscillators, then I guess it could be done pretty easily, but that's a pretty anharmonic potential.
Yes. This is certainly one of the main problems in the whole scheme. And I'm afraid that for now we don't know enough about the stability that we can achieve to know if it. I mean, in principle, it can work, right? If everything is stable enough, then that's fine. But we all know that things are not as stable as they should be. And so what we need to make an estimate is know a bit better what we can achieve here. So I'm afraid for the time being, I just don't know.
There be a way to impose a sort of a periodic test potential and see more insulated type transition in this structure as well? If you can split them up into two regions.
Yes, in principle, yes. I mean, but you have to bring the atoms much, much closer together than they are the distances between these periodic wells that I showed are really macroscopic, hundreds of microns. And if you want to couple these wells, it's simply not, it's vanishing coupling. So you have to bring them closer together, and you have to bring them so close together that with our lithographic technique for the time being, it's not possible. But of course, there are better techniques. Jörg Schmidmeier, for example, has a better technique which permits smaller structures. And so that should work out. The main question is, if you do that, then you also get closer to the surface. And if you are closer than, let's say, a micron to the surface, then an open question is, it's almost certain that the surface will start to heat the atomic sample. So it's not sure you can get to a micron or closer to the surface. And if you are not allowed to do that, then I'm not sure you can achieve this mod transition. Here, the distance between the atoms and the surface is still large. It's 80 microns or more. So we didn't observe heating due to that. right now.
Do you have a way to scale down the size of the cloud down to 1 for that experiment?
Well, in principle, if the trap, I mean, what you can do is make the trap shallower and less deep. So then atoms will start falling out. And as you have interaction between the atoms, you get levels you get level spacing which depends on the number of atoms, right? So if you open the trap just enough so that it can't take it can't contain 1,000 atoms anymore, but it can contain 500, then this is the idea. So probably you do something non-deterministic in the beginning, and then you would rely on such an effect to do to go down from
you
2 or 3. It seems to me that it should work. I mean, but of course, the first thing we want to do is do atom counting with these detectors, and then we'll see how we can go.
Yeah.